Thank you, Bruce, for that presentation. Very much. Yeah, I always said the most unfortunate thing that happened in 1776 was not our revolution, but the publication of The Wealth of Nations of Adam Smith. And it's time to close that chapter indeed. It is a real pleasure and a joy to introduce our next speaker, a great friend and comrade of mine, Randy Hayes. Those of you who were fortunate to hear Ralph Nader, if you were here Ralph Nader last night, a lot of you were here to hear Ralph. Yeah, now, if you think you're the smartest guy in the room, you're not once Ralph Nader gets into that room, trust me. Great friend. Ralph talked about the need for leadership, and I don't think anybody reflects that more, the fulfillment of that more than Randy Hayes. Randy has been a major leader in the environmental movement for decades. He created the Rainforest Action Network to be an amazing organization that it is today. He's currently a consultant with the World Future Council, and I'm honored that I've been able to co-found Foundation Earth with him, a new organization that's already having a big impact on the environmental movement, and that actually funded the pre-conference in San Francisco. Many of the people that presented here, without which this conference could never have taken place. Before that, though, Randy worked in government. He was actually the Green Czar. I think it was Director for Sustainability. Was that the actual title, Randy? For the city of Oakland, when Jerry Brown was the mayor there. Randy was also president of the San Francisco Commission on the Environment, I think for about 5 years. So he's seen it from both sides. He also has been arrested, I think, in 12 countries. Randy is known as one of the great strategic activists of our time, but I think most people don't know, and I know him so well. No one researches, does his homework, studies, and reads more about the environment and energy issues than Randy Hayes. He's not just a great activist, he's one of the great thinkers of our movement. And if there was an award for most fun to hang with in the environmental movement, there is no doubt he would get that award, Randy Hayes.
Here at the inaugural Fred Talks. Thank you, Tom Butler, for the parable yesterday, but also for designating these the Fred Talks. For those of you who weren't here yesterday, it stands for Facing the Reality of Extinction and Doom. So, fortunately, not all things are extinction and doom, at least not yet. In fact, if you listen really carefully, you can hear the simple, clear sound of appropriate technology. Mr. Timekeeper, the Tibetan bells. Now, in about, I thought it was about 8 minutes, but it turns out I was tasked to convey something to you, useful, hopefully, about the economic model for deep long-term sustainability. Can a true cost economy help retain us in the Holocene? Well, 20, 40, 60. Mr. Timekeeper, remember that conversation we had a little earlier about the relativity of the time, 2 hours. Well, now for my talk. In conclusion, high finance industrial casino capitalism is fundamentally it's unreformable, right? And there are 10 reasons to back up that assertion, therefore it must be true. However, there's really no coherent alternative model for deep long-term sustainability that has any wind in its sail right now. If you think about the other economic isms, be it Marxism or socialism or communism or capitalism, none of them gave a shit about nature. They still don't for the most part. I would contend, I hear you. Q&A will come up, right? And so I think that it does behoove of us to buy some time until somebody comes up with a little more wind in the sail of some of these alternative economic isms. And in terms of those 10 reasons for thinking that capitalism is fundamentally unreformable, I'll run through them quickly. Capitalism erodes and corrupts democracy, right? Capitalism is bottom feeding, pitting counties and states and countries against each other. It drives off accountability. Capitalism values are vastly insufficient. One example, it doesn't take care of things like child labor laws. It fails to help the poor. The model is really underserved about 3 billion people across the planet. Capitalism has a stability problem and a debt accumulation problem, and it's highly subsidized. Global capitalism undercuts local economies, as we heard from so many speakers. It undercuts diversity and fosters homogenization, and it destroys nature's very life support systems, which is dangerous. Well, fortunately, the framework for an economic model for deep long-term sustainability is not rocket science. I think it's actually relatively simple and straightforward in many respects, right? You think about the land and the sea and its capacity for self-renewal. This is the model for a healthy economy. You know, you can read about it in Andy's book, Salmon Economics. It operates on daily solar income. It efficiently recycles its nutrients. And more importantly, there's no phony bookkeeping. Phony bookkeeping is when you hide something important, right? But there's no phony bookkeeping in an alpine meadow. There's no phony bookkeeping in a salt marsh. There's no phony bookkeeping in a tropical rainforest, right? But you can find a lot of phony bookkeeping in that sort of high finance industrial casino economy, right? They're using phony bookkeeping to hide so many of their deeply harmful impacts against the planet's life support systems. Right. In fact, I think a simple name for the current economy that we have we call is cheater economics. The more you cheat the system, the more you cheat the earth and the future and the entire web of life, including us humans, the more profitable you are in the short term. So we have to confront cheater economics. So we ask ourselves, what are the ingredients of change, right? What are the qualities of the economic model for deep long-term sustainability? Right. Let's start with the gerrymander's excellent list. It's actually in your agenda, right? Where he talks about the ingredients of change. We start with primacy of scale, not large scale, but small scale. Not global, but local. The qualities go on with slower and less, and bottom up, and shared, and community owned, and microeconomic, and collaborative, and less trade, and less energy, and small business. Right? And at Foundation Earth, we published an essay on the true cost, towards a true cost economy, where we go into the 12 key principles, a guide in a holistic true cost economy, which you can find on our website. But it starts with the interdependence principle that we just heard about, really, where societal recognition is that nature nourishes all things, and that that's a far, far higher value than human self-interest. It goes on to the responsibility principle, where we think each generation should use less and less leave less and less of an ecological footprint, despite the population size or the consumption rates or the technology choices, right? We still, in whatever mix of those three elements, we still need to leave every subsequent generation with less and less of an ecological footprint, right? Every human has the duty to protect diversity of the whole. So the care and capacity principle simply says free markets are not free from ecological limits, as Manon Sheep often argues. The true cost principle, when pollution externalities are internalized, the price you pay for goods and services actually creates a situation where the ecologically cleanest is the financially cheapest. When you have the ecologically cleanest, the financially cheapest, we might be able to build a movement, bringing a lot of people, I think, on our side. And don't you think that a toxic tomato should cost more than a tomato? You know, we label our food organic food and food. That's a little bit wrong. It's food and toxic food. Toxic cotton costs more than organic cotton. A few more principles. The non-commodification of nature principle, which we heard about from the Indigenous Peoples panel. The precautionary principle, which has come up a number of times. The compassionate local self-reliance principle, right? Think of continental networks of bioregional economies. The compassionate part has to do that each bioregion should seek to, over time, continue to maximize its self-reliance. Not just the basic stuff of food, clothing, and shelter, but the comfort items of life as well. Right? And the compassionate part is to be there to help your neighbor, whether your neighbor is the next watershed or across the planet. Right? And primarily to help them become more self-reliant. I think the primary commodity, the things that we ought to trade globally, are art, culture, and ideas, not the stuff of our lifestyles. Another principle was the public governance principle, and the ecological or biospheric literacy principle, where wild nature operating on its according to its own laws becomes our principal teacher. The closed loop principle is important. An economy needs essentially to be a zero-waste, closed-loop, sustainable production and consumption system. There's the beginnings of that in Europe with some of the take-back factories that they have. The feedback principle is the 12th principle, and that's simply something that I learned from Fritjof Capra. Every living system must have accurate feedback loops to be self-correcting, right? And so our feedback loops will be things like the happiness index and the genuine progress indicator, and things like that. But there's another key aspect of the model for the economic model for deep long-term sustainability that's probably the most important aspect, at least in my mind, and that's just simply technology policy itself. Consider this quote from Jared Diamond, who wrote Guns, Germs, and Steel and Collapse. He knows something about the collapse of civilizations. He said, "All of our current environmental problems are unanticipated, harmful consequences of existing technology." Not some of them. He said, all of them. And he goes on to say that there is no basis for believing that technology will miraculously stop causing new and unanticipated problems while it is solving the problems that it previously produced. So, people say things like climate change is a problem, right? Bill McKibben said that to us yesterday. I want to challenge that for a moment, right? What is climate change? In a simple sense, right, climate change is just sort of the global warming from the burning of fossil fuels and deforestation, right? But another way to think about climate change is it's really just the symptom of a much deeper, more dangerous problem. Right? Let's go back to the 1700s, right? That's when Andy Kimbrell and I actually first met. We were in London, as I recall. You know? And we didn't use much energy. We burned a little bit of wood, right? And life was pretty good. And all of a sudden, Andy starts digging out coal from the hillside. And then he invents the steam engine, you know? And we think, hey, that's pretty cool, you know? That's kind of making life easier. And then time rolled by, and it was the 1800s, right? And Andy and I went into the sleazy bar, and we met these two other characters, Doug Tompkins and Wes Jackson, right? Doug was all excited because he just discovered oil and gas, you know? And Wes, being the clever guy that he is, he was excited because he invented some process that he was going to name the WJ process, but he ended up calling it the Haber-Bosch process, right? And we thought, wow, this is pretty wonderful, right? You know, it just all seemed like a good idea at the time, but we didn't realize that there was going to be a terrible price to pay for these energy technology choices that we were making back then, right? That it was going to shred literally the web of life itself and start to superheat the planet that we live on. It's not climate change. We're turning the blue sky into a toxic furnace. It's dangerous stuff, right? And we need a plan for this. And part of that plan, it strikes me, is the technology policy for a nation state, right? Michael Huseman yesterday mentioned that he thought Sweden had the beginnings of it, but it was really lacking quite a lot. So perhaps what we need is an Unanticipated Consequences Act of 2015, where we would register our technologies and authorize them and report on them and have five-year national assessment reports to try to figure out the unanticipated consequences, at least early on, so we can make some adjustments, right? I'm hoping somebody in the audience will simply write the Unanticipated Consequences Act of 2015, send it on down to Washington, D.C., the Foundation Earth offices, and we'll start shopping it around. If we can't get it through the U.S. Congress, we'll send it over to Iceland or the German Green Party or something, you know. We've got to start making things happen, right? So a key point here really is that if you misidentify the nature of the problem, you're really quite likely to misidentify the better nature of the real solutions. Right? So, in conclusion, we need to ask ourselves, can we ecologize industrial capitalism? Well, no, we kind of covered that, right? But again, we damn well better make some major damage control to buy some time. And I actually believe that that can be done. If you think about the global economy from an ecological perspective, to me, there's two major things that it fails greatly at. One of them is around carrying capacity. There are no institutions to ratchet economic activity down around carrying capacity limits, whether that's atmospheric, global carrying capacities, or continental or bioregional. We have to come up with these institutions. If you think about the cap and trade program around global warming, right? If they'd have called it cap and reduce, which is what it is, people would have got that you put a ceiling on it and you start ratcheting it down. It would have been more saleable. The second main thing that global capitalism doesn't do well from an ecological perspective is there's no systematic way to internalize those pollution externalities, right? It's not really about internalizing them in the sense of price. It's really about eradicating them so they don't exist in the first place, right? We have to come up with a system where the market signals tell the ecological truth, right? And I believe that what we're going to find is that history is going to record industrial civilization over the last couple of hundred years as the real bubble economy. Why? Because it does not tell the ecological truth, right? And it uses phony bookkeeping. Now, Wes may argue that it's not the 200 years of industrial economy or industrial civilization. Maybe it goes back 7 or 10,000 years to agriculture, but we'll fight that one out, right? Industrial civilization just simply does not abide by the immutable principles of ecology, as we've heard this morning at different panels. There are key steps to do the damage control on the existing model, right? And one of them, Foundation Earth did a quite detailed report called Mandatory Corporate Ecological Impact Disclosure, a working paper. Right? But this is really about how the Security Exchange Commission could require voluntary codes of conduct are not getting the job done. We won a lot of those battles at the Rainforest Action Network. They did not create the Great Ecological U-Turn. But this is about mandatory corporate ecological impact disclosure. And that means includes the way we've written it up, even the entire supply chains for the corporations around the world, right? And so, fundamental to any new economy that thinks it's a better economy is going to be excellent transparency, particularly of ecological impacts, but particularly in terms of the great cycles of the planet, right? The biosphere's life support systems. The data from this would be independently. We don't trust the corporations to do this reporting, so we've come up with a strategy to like a certified public accountant, that these would be certified ecological auditors, and the data would be publicly available to the world. And again, you can get this on our website. But in conclusion, yet again, Bill McKibben is my friend. I know Bill McKibben. And I actually really believe Bill McKibben is a heroic person, right? But I also believe that he gets part of his message, just part of his message, wrong. And that's that he says that stopping fossil fuel and climate change is the most important issue of our time, right? Well, the biosphere's life support systems, according to one scientific framework, the planetary boundaries, has 9 slices of the pie, 9 key aspects. And they can calculate a safe operating zone for each of those 9 different aspects of the planet's life support systems, right? And 3 of those 9 are off the chart, and one of them, in fact, is climate change, right? But it's also the nitrogen cycle and the phosphorus cycle of the planet are just off the cliff, right? But the one that's most off the cliff actually turns out to be biodiversity loss. Now, the main point here is that if you lose any one of those 9, you lose it all. So to me, the most important message is that we have to be responsible to the whole. Each of us in this room today, the entirety of humanity, that's the message that we've got to get out. And final conclusion. It's become clear to me, that $60 was just not enough to buy more time, the timekeeper. And so I shall leave by beseeching you to keep thinking and learning. And thank you so much for coming to this teaching, right? Keep speaking out about the ecological truth, that nature needs us to be the great ecological truth tellers. Leading society simply to be in sync with nature's way, the way we heard from Vandana Shiva and a number of the native people on that panel, right? And if we do all of that, we'll have an earth that's abundant with birdsong, and we'll have oceans once again teeming with those whales and their symphonic songs. So thank you all very much.